I'm like everybody else. I'm trying to make heads or tails of what we've learned this week from the conference. And the procedural part of it, I don't think there's much arguing in the better safe than sorry part, but there's a faction of fans and everybody else that thinks it's just as simple as, why don't we play and see where the chips fall? But I think the Big Ten has told you it's a lot more complicated than that, because it's not the football coaches and the athletic directors making the decision. It's the infectious disease specialists, the doctors, the people at these research universities who do this for a living are telling the people that do sports for a living, hey, you need to listen to what we've said. That's what the Big Ten has taken on. Now what do we do?
Well, that's a good question, and I think that for all of the the pantomime and maybe to some extent all of the sort of theatrics of this week around the league, one of the justifiable, in my mind anyway, complaints is people who just felt like there wasn't kind of enough communication through this. Obviously, all the principal parties were meeting a lot virtually, of course, as everyone else is. The presidents were meeting. The presidents and chancellors were meeting regularly. My understanding is the ADs have been meeting very regularly through all this. Obviously, this wasn't the athletic director's decision. But the point is, a lot of the decision makers in the conference have been meeting on a variety of issues for a long time, just because, number one, it's easy, and number two, everybody kind of needs to stay in touch. But you did sort of sympathize with coaches who said, we don't have any guidance right now. We don't know it's not just that we don't know what decision is going to get made, but we don't know what happens after that. Will we have, we're going to have a ton of questions from our athletes about practice, about eligibility, about scholarships. How do we answer any of those questions? And I think there was, much less the Leviathan task of a spring season. Can we get anything essentially beyond the decision itself to kind of walk us through what this is potentially going to take?
So they're mad because the decision was made and they didn't have an immediate plan B to fall back on, even though they were in these discussions all these times,
Let's be clear. Coaches weren't. And I think that even when you watch sort of Kevin Warren's appearance on the Big Ten Network Tuesday morning, was that Tuesday morning at this point?
Tuesday at 3:00.
The week has pretty much blurred into one very, very long day for me at this point. He wasn't even particularly forthcoming with details then. Now, to be clear, it's not like the Big Ten could present a 1,000-page document answering every question. And it just was a feeling of, well, if this is a monument, and again, I'm moving aside for a moment some of the theatrics out of Lincoln, out of Columbus, out of Ann Arbor. This is such a monumental decision. Can we not get just a little bit more sort of coherent messaging from the conference about, hey, this is what we're trying to do? These are at least the immediate next steps that you could start to give athletes some answers now. As for the decision itself, I think you were absolutely right there at the top. This stems from the uncertainty around, that we still have around COVID-19. I think one of the things that does get lost a lot in what becomes very rapidly a sort of hypercharged political discourse around the pandemic at the moment, whether it should be political or not, is the reality that the medical experts will tell you we're still figuring a lot out about this disease. We've had less than a year with it. When you think about the amount of time we have to research all of the known diseases that humankind has ever had to deal with, we've had less than a year with this. So it's the combination of concerns over not just its spread and its transmissibility, but also its after effects. One of the big ones we've heard being myocarditis, the heart condition that does seem to be prevalent even in young people who recover from this. And the uncertainty around basically being able to say, well, what is the long-term risk? If we're talking about these conditions, what is the long-term risk? And I know some other conferences have pushed forward based on what I've heard. I don't know that you're going to see anybody. I don't know how feasible it's going to be for anybody to get to football season, but we'll see what comes in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm not saying the Big Ten's right for being first. I think only time will tell that. But the understanding where the decision came from is absolutely fair. I think that the one thing that coaches around the conference, and I would say this probably isn't even just football coaches, just had hoped for a little bit more of an open line of communication from the league about basically what the immediate next steps would be. I mean, like, for example, when the decision came down, nobody knew if they could even keep practicing. And it's something as simple as basically saying to your guys, either you're showing up here tomorrow or you're not.
I know you don't have the answer to this question, but why even get to the practice part? Why did they were – everybody was – in the timeline is this. Everybody that came to campus was in voluntary workouts until when? And then why did, after the next step in this, why did you release a schedule? And then after releasing a schedule, why did you take the next step of saying, okay, now we can move to phase two in our practice and then move that backwards? Why didn't you just can it from the beginning and not put all this pile of false hope up there? We're only talking about 6 days, not talking about 6 weeks.
Right, but I think that as you were, this again comes to maybe to some extent the sort of decentralized nature of the decision-making process within the league and even just more broadly within college football. And I know you and I talked about this when I jumped in here on Tuesday.
That's right. I forgot you were on.
the teams, again, you have to understand there's different structures in terms of like the coaches are at one level of kind of the decision-making tree. You know, the coaches have authority over certain things in the conference. They meet regularly, of course, even in non-COVID-19 times. Then the athletic directors have authority over certain things. Then the council of presidents and chancellors has authority over certain things. The coaches needed to be able to be told, if we can make this happen, and if the council of presidents and chancellors' decision is to try and forge ahead with the football season, we plan to start here. And then here's the schedule. Here are the contingencies we're going to build in for the potential for, you know, games to have to be forfeited or postponed or whatever, you know, pushed back. Because you need the schedule to know when you can start preseason camp. Because NCAA rules still apply in terms of saying you can begin practice X number of physical days before your first game, and you get X number of practices over the period of time between the day you're allowed to start practice. You don't have to start on the day you're allowed to, of course, just, you know, many, many do, if not everyone, but you don't have to start that day, but your window does not open until X date working backward from your first game. Then you have to do a certain number of practices only in helmets and what we used to call shirts and shorts.
But this, no pads. You're making my point.
Then you ramp up to pads.
You're making my point.
Your argument's not with Kevin Warren in that instance. Your argument should be with the presidents and chancellors. And maybe you can make an argument for Kevin Warren needing to get into that room, metaphorically speaking, of course, and say, listen, we can't be sitting here talking about a season that we may cancel in a week. We need a decision now.
Yes, absolutely right.
But from the infrastructural standpoint, Kevin Warren and the Big Ten office needed to give their coaches and their programs a calendar to work off of, because they could not hold indefinitely and then say, oh, by the way, we're starting play in 17 days. Crash course your players into shape and let's go.
The other part of this that I don't have an issue with, but it makes sense, is you just detailed a multi-level step functioning how we get the season started plan that is just not shoot the gun and everybody takes off running. There, it's very detailed. It's very intricate. We canceled the season and didn't have one detail or intricacy. So you've just shown the complete 180 degrees of the Big Ten in what you just said, and how they procedurally will start the season, and then how they ended the season is devoid of any procedure whatsoever. So I can see why people are upset.
And again, I mean, I think what just this comes down to, there are dozens of layers here that you can sort of criticize different people for everything that's happened in the last 4 or 5 days. I do think it's important to remember that at the end of the day, everybody's process is corrupted right now. Nobody can meet in person. Nobody can have the kinds of one-on-one conversations you need to try and have to get these things done. Kevin Warren can't get into a conference room with all of his, you know, his commissioners, his associate commissioners to discuss different contingencies. Yes, you can do all these things digitally, but it's just not as easy. And as anybody right now who's listening, who's working from home knows, you're not working 8:30 to 5 because you've got a couple kids that need homeschooled or they can't go to summer camp. Or, I mean, you know, it just, the reality is we are all working on, you know, busted up schedules right now. And so in addition to the fact that you're dealing with a commissioner who has been thrown into like the deep end of the ocean, not even the pool, the ocean, in his first 8 months on the job, you also have no way of physically getting everybody into one place to make these sorts of impactful decisions in a situation where you can close the door and all anybody has to worry about physically is sitting there and making the decisions and mapping out what comes next. It is difficult. And listen, I was critical of Kevin Warren this week in what I wrote. I was critical of college athletics leadership in what I wrote. I hope that no one read that and thought, well, he's just completely blaming them. He thinks it's all their fault. This is an incredibly difficult time. I do think, though, that everybody involved needs to kind of see what's happened in the last 4 or 5 days and step up and say, listen, if we're going to navigate this without calamity, and I'm talking about calamity even beyond losing a football season or postponing it to spring with some, you know, with some public infighting going on in the press, but I'm talking about losing millions and millions and millions of dollars. I'm talking about losing basketball season. I'm talking about not being able to make a spring season work, not being able to find a way to salvage what you can for these athletes and these coaches, et cetera. Then everybody needs to kind of see this as a wake-up call and remember that at the end of the day, they are all pulling in the same direction and the boat is only going to move as fast as they can move together.
Zach Osterman's our guest. He checks in from the Indianapolis Star. He's the beat writer for IU football and IU basketball. Obviously, we've been talking about this for 5 months. Wait longer. It's not an emergency situation. Why did we pull the plug when we pulled it? What are your thoughts on that? Why didn't we give it till the end of simply because of travel plans and wasted more money? Would that be an accurate way of looking at it?
You know, I think,
and I know you don't know this for sure. I'm asking you to speculate.
I mean,
you've been around.
I think there are a couple of things. I think on the one hand, I would say that from a basic standpoint, it's not, you don't have to go very far to make the argument that practicing games carry some of the same risks. Obviously, a game is different in one sense because you have to take two groups of people that have been working very hard to isolate themselves as much as possible and suddenly basically say that isolation is completely out the window for 4 quarters, you know, 4 hours. You've got to be in incredibly close proximity to one another, et cetera. But you've also got those, you know, those you've still got, if you're practicing in full pads, a bunch of people in really, really close proximity. And we're in a situation where you can't bubble these athletes up, which means you can't guarantee that none of them are out, you know, whether they're being reckless or not with their behavior, picking up the virus. And then all of a sudden, just from a pure transmissibility standpoint, you're dealing with the same issue, if that makes sense. The other question, and I think this is a question that a lot of people have asked, is, and this is one that we're not going to have an answer to until we have hindsight. You know, the old hindsight is 2020 phrase, but sometimes hindsight is 2020 because you need it to be able to see perfectly clearly. The other thing that I would say that a lot of people have asked is, why not wait until students come back and see how that goes? Now, the risk there is if you do that, and I think that is probably where the SEC and maybe the ACC are mentally right now in terms of their decision-making process. If you do that and it turns out to be just an absolute atom bomb of infection and spread, then you have put your athletes doubly at risk or triply at risk. And so, again, this is one where I say hindsight being 2020 is sometimes the only way we're going to know whether the decision was right or not. If we get to the SEC opening its campuses for fall semester, and hey, it turns out that the ones with good, you know, detailed, comprehensive, you know, interventionist plans for testing and contact tracing and limiting spread actually can have a football season, then we'll look back on this and we'll say the Big Ten made the wrong decision and they made it too soon. If the SEC opens its campuses, or even frankly, if the Big Ten opens its campuses and we immediately see huge flare-ups of COVID-19 among just the regular student population, then we will probably wind up saying it was better that they shut practice down when they did. That's just one I think we can't know yet.
The interesting part of this is when all of these voluntary workouts began in July, number one, they staggered them all to come in at separate times to mitigate, hopefully, not crowding in doing whatever the case was. But we do know over a three-week period, football starts here, then we're going to do some basketball, then we're going to do, this week is going to be women's soccer and field hockey, and this week's going to be men's soccer and volleyball. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, after all these student athletes had to pass a test to get to their voluntary workouts, we learned 33 or so athletes and administrators have gotten COVID, and that's without 45,000 people on campus. So I'm not a math guy, and that's probably smart on my part, but we're talking about 200 athletes and however many of them got COVID from not having a campus full of people. The numbers to extrapolate there, and again, I'm not a math guy, seem to be pretty obvious, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's hard to argue the math. But if people say, well, they're healthy and they're not going to die, what the hell? Let's have football. Let's not run businesses out of it. Oh, that's a tough call for a university president. That's a tough call for a commissioner.
You really get into liability issues. And
is that the major issue? Why did the NCAA say we're not going to let them sign liability waivers? What if people wanted to play and say, well, I'm young, I don't care, I'll sign the waiver. I need to get to the NFL. I need to get to MLS or whatever it is. Why did the NCAA can that and handcuff themselves?
You know, I mean, I'd also say, too, and this is, listen, don't press me on this because I can't give you the absolute detail of it. You know, liability waivers aren't always the most legally enforceable things in the world.
Okay.
That has always been my understanding. Now, of course, universities can have airtight, you know, they can have an entire general counsel's office sitting there drawing up, dotting every I, closing every loophole, you know, tying up every loose end. And maybe by that point, maybe if you do that, yeah, they will be. But then we're sitting there and we're saying, we're going to all this trouble to ask amateur unpaid athletes to play sports in the middle of a pandemic when we don't have control of the spread of it in the country more widely, when we cannot I don't even want to say for certain, when we cannot in all likelihood guarantee that we are going to be able to control the spread of it on the campuses, though it's possible. You do get to a point where you say, what are we doing then? Like if we're going to all this trouble and we're adding all these layers and we're bending over so far backwards, shouldn't we just look at it and say, maybe this isn't worth it? Maybe this isn't the right thing to do. And I don't know that I think only hindsight is going to tell us whether or not these were the right decisions made this week by the Big Ten and the Pac-12. But, you know, it does feel a little bit that way where you start to say, well, get them to sign liability waivers and put them in athlete-only dorms and go through all these layers. And you look at it and you say, you know, unless we're paying them and treating them like employees, is this right? Is it ethical? Is it moral? If nothing else, is it worth it?
What's the upside?
That's the upside is
they play football. Yeah. Broadcast rights would come in.
Yeah.
That's the upside.
The sort of the machine continues churning.
I saw today that the IU Board of Trustees is getting together to discuss their $3 billion budget. How much of that is athletics?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean,
$150 million, $140 million?
Their last reported number was about 127. Now, I guess I don't know. I assume that would fall into that larger number.
Let's say it doesn't. Just to put it in the scope of university talk, they're discussing a $3 billion budget. And athletics by itself in the university is $150 million. That's not even a blip on the radar.
Right.
I mean, it's not money you flush down the toilet and say goodbye, but in the grand scheme of things, and people
and, an athletics department is something that, under normal circumstances should be protected by a university. It is a major forward facing arm of that university.
Advertisement, and whatever.
All those things. But you're right. I mean, Indiana's endowment's almost $2.5 billion. You know,
it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you a question in this sense of it, because it seems like there is a part of the country, you could argue the ACC, SEC, if you want to argue that's part of the country, Big 12, these conference states, and the conferences stretch all over the place. They're weird. Like, for example, West Virginia's in the Big 12. Okay, whatever. Why do health experts differ in opinion in these regions? Why have the health professionals or the committee that has 17 names that I can never remember off the top of my head that the Big Ten put together, why are they saying one thing and then another part of the country, the message is completely different?
In fairness, this is where I'm probably a little bit out of my depth.
Because you're not an epidemiologist?
Right. And of course, I've listened to epidemiologists, but, you know, it if I can speculate for a moment, I think a couple things come to mind. Number one, of course, we can have scientific research. You can't argue with science, but epidemiology and projecting the spread of things and the danger of certain things can still be a bit nebulous at times because you are counting on behaviors and occurrences that haven't happened yet. Number two, and this kind of is the underpinning of number one, and I mentioned it earlier, we just don't know enough about this virus. You know, if in a year the research comes out and says, listen, we were overstating the concerns about after effects, the cardiovascular and neurological after effects. And by the way, that hasn't gotten talked about a lot, but there is some really concerning evidence, even in young people, about severe neurological effects in more extreme cases, like people having to reteach themselves how to walk or write or talk. So we're not just talking about, you know, migraine headaches. You know, if in a year we find out that was all overblown, I'm sure a lot of people say, see, we should have known then, but how could we know then? Because we have to have the time to properly research. It's the same reason that, you know, we heard reputable, proven, experienced pharmaceutical companies talking about having a vaccine in production or in its process in January, but we're still not expecting one to be widely available until sometime early next year, maybe late winter, early spring. It's because we need time with this. This can't be rushed. You need time to be able to observe it. There's just no way to cut that corner. And so I think there's probably an element of that too, in just basically different people, because there are still things that we cannot empirically say about this virus. Different people are going to interpret the data and the research that we have in different ways.
All right, let's take a timeout. When we come back, you wrote an article this week at the IndyStar.com and IndyStar hardcover paper, wherever you grab that, about the financial ramifications of not having fall sports in general. We'll also talk about if there can be a plan for spring. We talked about Las Vegas having their thoughts about that. Jeff Brohm has grabbed a cocktail napkin and sketched out a plan or two as well. We'll see if any of that stuff makes any sense after we take a quick timeout. We'll do a little Network Indiana news as well, and more when we return with Zach Osterman from the Indianapolis Star. We thank Carpets Plus Color Tile, the largest selection of Karastan flooring in South Central Indiana. Carpets Plus Color Tile, Liberty Drive across from Menards. Show for Paws. That event is going on right now. Stop by and say hi. You couldn't have picked, and I'm glad I don't have much radio show left. You couldn't have picked a better night not to have the Reds on the radio. Anthony DeSclafani, Anthony, is throwing batting practice at the Great American Launching Pad. He has given up 3 home runs, 8 hits, and 6 earned runs, and there's 1 out in the second. It is 6-0 Pittsburgh. Eight hits. Did I say, how many did I say? 8 hits. Placido Polanco. I don't even know if that's, no, it's Gregor Polanco. Home run. I don't know half these guys. They're all hitting home runs. And I don't know what that means, but doesn't sound very good. Let's try to reconnect with Zach Osterman, shall we? I think that was the beeping we heard in the background. That is the beeping. Let's turn that down. Kyle Hart update, the former IU left-handed ace. He is getting his first major league start this afternoon in Boston for the Red Sox. The big left-hander got a little roughed up in inning number one, and he has been roughed up since. We should just turn off baseball for the rest of the day because it is not working out the way we would like it to. Kyle, who gave up 2 in the first, has now given up 3 in the top of the third. 6 hits, 5 runs, 3 of them earned, 3 walks. That doesn't help anything. 2 home runs, et cetera, et cetera. So a tough pitching performance for the Indiana Hoosier left-hander, and they are struggling. He trailed 2-0 in the first and then rallied. The Red Sox did. They got 3 in the bottom to make it 3-2, and now it's 5-3 Tampa. So we don't have any good pitching news to report, and I'm having a hard time connecting with Zach Osterman. We have lost his Skype signal, but we're trying to dial him back. You know what we'll do? We'll just bring him back in on the phone since I can't bring him in here. Let's try that. We have multiple ways of getting him going. I just want to hear his thoughts on a couple more things here. I don't want to talk about baseball anymore today. We'll do that tomorrow. Chuck Crabb joins us for Big Show Friday tomorrow. Joe Smith is back as well. We are more than socially distanced. Don't worry about that. 7-0 Pirates. What's the old joke? You can go get him now. He's got to get in there. He's got to eat some innings up. But the Reds trailing 7-0, the top of the second, just 1 out as Anthony DeSclafani. 9 hits allowed, throwing batting practice. No Reds on the radio tonight. It's David Hayes, your money coming up at 6. All right, let's try to bring Zach Osterman back in the fold. Are you there, my good friend?
If you can hear me, I am.
Outstanding. I do hear you. That's the good news. We had to switch our mediums of communication, which we're very flexible in this day and age. All right, so here we go. Jeff Brohm's got a cocktail napkin out. He says, here's my plan for spring, the Pac-12. I saw you tweet out that article. I hadn't had a chance to crack the paywall yet on that one about the Pac-12 has this big plan they've devised. The Big Ten really hasn't announced anything yet. Where are we? Where are we going? And how much is this going to cost Indiana University? I'll lump that into one big question for you.
Well, I think, you know, that we really don't have answers on the first one. And I think for as much as maybe we do criticize the Big Ten for not kind of having too many of those answers right away, I think after the week that the Big Ten had, it would probably behoove the conference, you know, just frankly to give that a minute. And when they do move forward, don't just sort of lash it out willy-nilly, if you want to say. I think that there's probably some value in that attitude as well. I would expect that we will, at the conference level, they will be having some extensive discussions both about spring football and also obviously about basketball. Because as you asked the question about money, you're talking about departments standing to lose probably anywhere between $60 and $100 million, maybe even more than that in some cases, if there is no revenue sports period this year. You know, I think you can get very quickly into, I mean, talking about the kind of financial meltdown or catastrophe that would genuinely cause, I mean, just widespread chaos. And I don't mean that
it's not anarchy.
I don't mean to. But in terms of losing sports, in terms of losing scholarships, certainly in terms of the mass downsizing of athletics departments. I mean, I tweeted something earlier today. I tweeted out a story today just talking about what the different options might be for basically covering shortfalls when nothing's going on. And as I expected, somebody, you know, somebody responded and said, oh, you know, these departments have been getting fat, let them suffer a little bit. And I just said, listen, I get that, but you're talking about,
it's already been spent.
Like widespread job losses, widespread sport losses. You know, I mean, you're talking about schools maybe cutting their sports offerings in half.
Well, now that we're here, what do we do?
Well, so to shamelessly plug my story.
Please do. That's why you're on this air.
There's, I think, a few options, some of them a lot simpler than others. The Pac-12 is reportedly considering basically a widespread loan program that the conference will set up for the schools, and so it'll flow through the conference. It's as much as $83 million over 10-year 3.75% interest rate. The collateral on that will be the Pac-12's upcoming ongoing television deal. And I think that would be one way that conferences could tackle this. Another way would obviously be universities helping departments, you know, with some sort of fronting of cash. Universities are going to be dealing with their own shortages at this point. But maybe you find a way to roll some athletics debt, particularly at places like Indiana, you know, conferences like the Big Ten, where most of your departments are not really reliant on university funding at all. You find a way to roll that debt into the wider university problem and help address it, just so you don't have mass losses in that department, just the way you don't want mass losses anywhere else. I think there's even a world, though this is pure speculation, where we could talk about a bailout of some kind, not necessarily for college athletics, but if the situation becomes grave, you know, for higher education more widely, could we see movement toward some sort of federal stimulus for higher education, of which athletics could receive a portion? Because I think, and I talked to a professor at the Kelley School of Business who helped me sort of game this out. He's obviously smarter about this than I am, but one of the things we talked about is athletics. Whatever you may think of paying coaches $3 million, whatever, blah, 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 the new facilities, all that. Sure, they would probably have to make some concessions, some cuts, maybe rein in, you know, this era of excess spending, so to speak. But you would also be able to make a strong case for the importance of saving an athletics department in terms of its local economic impact, its impact on the brand value of the university, its impact on basically the university's ability to market itself nationally and even internationally. You can make a strong case that under that sort of circumstance, athletics deserves some help. Now, you know, do we wind up there? That's the hardest one to sort of forecast. To me, it seems a lot more likely that what you'll see is either some sort of conference arrangement like the Pac-12. The Big Ten would not comment to me on that possibility when I contacted them last week, or a university by university structure wherein some of these departments, perhaps in particular the ones that have been able to operate, you know, with so much self-sufficiency in the last decade or so, going to the universities and saying, listen, we need some help now.
And this is all in loan form, correct?
Well, I couldn't sit here and tell you how. If Indiana University more widely said, listen, we're going to rescue the athletic department, we're going to front them $65 million to help them cover this lost revenue, I don't know how that would work. I don't know that would be structured like a loan.
We're way past bake sales and car washes, that's for sure.
Right. But if it was a third party sort of support, yes, I think at that point you would be talking about some sort of loan. And that's what was really interesting about the Pac-12's program. Not that it would solve everyone's problem, but, you know, I mean, listen, I think the maximum was $83 million that schools could withdraw. They don't have to withdraw that many. But they you know, that's the max, or that much I should say, but that is the maximum they can withdraw. If you were able to build something commensurate for the Big Ten, which I would argue, though I don't think there's as much value left in the Big Ten's TV rights deal just because of where it is in the life. I think it's, I want to say it has about 2.5 years left to run.
Sounds right.
It's still, I can make you an argument that the Big Ten as a brand would probably be able to secure an even larger loan.
Yeah, I was going to go that direction as well, because the power they will. Yeah.
Yeah, and the, you know, the future earnings, they could potentially sort of convince a third party lender to allow them to use as collateral. You know, I mean, Indiana reported in the fiscal year 2019 a little over $80 million in football, men's basketball specific revenue. A loan doesn't fix everything, but it does potentially get you to a point where maybe you're not going through mass layoffs, where you're not having to cut, you know, a half dozen sports.
I'm not going to ask you what you can.
You can save the face, essentially, of your athletics department, while also finding a way to navigate all of the financial challenges here.
And this isn't something that's going to happen next week, where they're going to get a letter in the mail and say, "Oh, I'm sorry if you're on the soccer team, volleyball team, field hockey team. That sorry, we're not coming back next year." We're not overreacting that quickly. What are we going to do, though, in spring? Jeff Brohm wants to play. Everybody wants to play. Here's a season. Here's why we can do it. Look, shove it in, shove it out. And then you got somebody that says, no, we can't play in spring if we're going to play in fall next year. And everybody has an opinion on what's going to happen. What is tangible to do in the springtime, if anything? And who's going to have the last say on that? Is that going to be the doctors as well? Or help me out.
Well, I think, certainly in terms of, to just work backward, the last say, so to speak, I think that it's going to be the same decision-making apparatus you see, where you're going to need the athletic director, the coaches to sign off on certain things, the athletic directors to agree to certain things, and then the conference to agree to certain things, the presidents to, you know, to agree to certain things, particularly, I think, as it pertains ultimately to the spread of the virus and the ways in which the virus you know, is or isn't contained. Now, there are 1,000 questions to answer for a spring season. Some of them are, you know, ethical, like as you mentioned, is it ethically sound to ask a bunch of amateur athletes to play even an abbreviated spring schedule? And I've seen the Jeff Brohm plan. I know that it's basically an 8-game season, I think wrapping up sometime in early mid-May with some sort of postseason structure, and then like a massive amount of time off, like no workouts basically at all. And then they come back in like August or early September and then play a 10-game season, I think, starting in October. But people would say, well, 18 games, that's still a lot. And it's a lot to ask of athletes who've obviously already been through a lot. And geez, when we were playing 15-game seasons, we were already having some conversations about the potential ethical quandaries here. Is that too many? Are we getting too close to a professional model? That's one to address. And then all the things that come with that around amateurism, around eligibility. I know that the NCAA has recommended some pretty lenient sort of eligibility exceptions for athletes who lose their fall season. You also have a ton of logistical questions. Do you want to be playing outside in Big Ten country in February? Can you make some sort of bubble happen? Can you go to domed stadiums? If you do that, can you ensure the safety of athletes in terms of the sanitation of the places they stay, the places that they eat? You know, there's what happens are freshmen who sign in December and decide to enroll in January, are they immediately eligible? Or, you know, because technically if they enrolled in January in a normal circumstance, they wouldn't play a season until the fall. Do you have to shelve them until the fall season? Because you often have concerns, not about every kid, but with a lot of kids, concerns about physical readiness. And if they're showing up on January 7th and your first game is February 18th, you know, can you get them ready in that space of time? Is it fair to let, you know, that suddenly becomes a huge recruiting tool if you are, if you say yes, schools can do that, is it fair to do that? Can you extend scholarship limits so that basically you can afford to bring a full class of freshmen in, but also keep all your seniors on scholarship for one more semester? There are so many questions that need answered, and you would think, you would hope that there's somebody somewhere in a room starting to tick these off. And there are some that have been answered, again, like the NCAA's pronouncements about eligibility and scholarship assurance and things like that. But a spring season comes with a ton of logistical challenges, none more fundamental than just the basic concern of whether we can get to January, February, and the situation in this country with regard to COVID-19 has changed.
And here we are with Zach Osterman trying to figure out how this is all going to work. And we just have about 2 minutes left, so I will just stir the pot briefly. Maui, when are we leaving for Maui? Basketball season. How are we going to do that?
I mean, last I heard from the organizers of the Maui Invitational was they still planned to hold it in November. I'll be honest with you, reading the room, and obviously this isn't just Maui specific, I would be really very, very surprised if we see any events like that this season. We are getting to a point where I would be very, very surprised if we see non-conference basketball games in the Power Five. I know the Pac-12 is basically in effect already canceled its non-conference season. Again, what you know about what other conferences are planning is only kind of coming out in rumor and whispers and, you know, little dribs and drabs. But I would expect at this point that it's, or I guess maybe the better way to put it is, at this point, the strong impression that I get is that the most obvious way forward for these Power Five conferences is not going to involve non-conference games. And of course, that would potentially include all the showcase events, all the, you know, the one day games, the tournaments, everything. And of course, that would include the Maui Invitational.
And there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. Mike DeWine said Ohio is going to announce their high school sports next week, how that works itself out. I saw today Texas Tech said they're going to have 25,000 people in the stands for their games. That's interesting. The Reds are getting clobbered. The Yankees aren't beating up the Braves tonight, are they? They get a night off from that? Is that what I saw?
I believe this is the Braves' first day off since the season resumed.
Yeah, it's weird because obviously everybody's going to try to play 60 games in 66 days, and where those days fall in are tough. Speaking of tough, Kyle Hart made the show today. That's fantastic news for the former Indiana left-hander. But It's tough up there. Pitched 2 innings, 7 hits, 7 runs. 5 of them were earned. Walked 3 and struck out 4. But his day is over as the Rays are beating the Red Sox 7-3. And the Reds are getting bombed. Other than that, I have no good baseball news for you, my friend. I'm sorry. But we thank you for your time. We want you to stay we want you to stay safe and keep bringing us great information. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, as always. Bye.
We'll see you soon, Raccoon. Zach Osterman from the Indianapolis Star, the beat writer for Indiana football and Indiana basketball. And, we'll see what's next. We'll talk to Zach every week and keep our eyes monitoring the situation moving forward. And we hope to bring some good news at some point.